This is the Counter Ruck Rugby Podcast, brought to you by the Irish Times in association with Nifty Business. My name is Nathan Johns. As one Six Nations ends, another begins. After Ireland men won their competition last week, the women get underway this weekend in France. We're going to preview the tournament today, and I'm joined by Irish Times rugby writer John O'Sullivan and by John Cronin. JC, as he is affectionately known, was the former director of rugby at Railway Union, one of the more dominant clubs in the Women's All-Ireland League, and therefore a bulk provider of players to the Irish squad. JC knows plenty of the Irish squad very well, and he's also been a very vocal voice, both in the media and on social media, for how to improve the women's game after what has been a difficult couple of years. Right, well, let's start with kind of a more broad point, because as we know, one Six Nations ends, another one begins after the men won their competition last week. The women start a week after a reasonably new development. It's only in the last couple of years that they've moved the women's competition away from being the same weekend as both the men's and the 20s. And you know, a lot of people supported that move, that it gave them more airtime, so to speak. But they start this weekend away to France. And alongside me, John O'Sullivan and John Cronin, podcast hosts, worst nightmare. You've got two people with the same name, so you can't just say, John, tell me about this, John, tell me about that. So apologies for the convoluted full names.
You can be polite to John and call him John, and you can just go you to me.
I'm happy with JC. It'll work.
Perfect. Right, well, JC, we'll start with just where this squad is more generally. You've obviously been kind of boots on the ground for a long time now. You were coaching and director of Rugby Railway for 12 years. You've taken a step back, but you know, you still know lots of the players quite well, still very engaged with the game. Look, there's been a lot of off-field negativity in the last couple of years with the women's game, the infamous letter that was written to government, the reaction, the social media storm that followed, players got caught up in a little bit. They've changed head coaches in the last 12 months. But there has been, you know, a little bit of positivity since then. They did go to a brand new competition with the WXV3, it was called, and they beat Spain in the final of that to win. So they got their hands on a bit of silverware, John. What did you take away from that and where this group is? Was that just a case of, they put 100 points on a team like Kazakhstan and you can't take a lot from it because of the opposition? Or was the fact that they beat Spain, one of the teams that cost them World Cup qualification a couple of years ago, was that a sign of genuine progress?
I think we probably need to have some patience with this squad because it is a very young group in terms of training age and playing age. And a lot of players are just, coming off not a lot of game time, not a lot of training time. And they've started to go into, performance type programs. So there's a bit of patience we need around the group. I would say with the WX15s, it was desperately weak. And it's just the nature of where the international game is at the moment. There's a buddy of mine, John Phelan, he used to be the coach of Kazakhstan, an Irish guy, and he'd actually WhatsApped me before the game and said, look, this is going to be 100 points because Kazakhstan sevens were playing and a lot of their athletes were gone out there. So there's not a lot we can learn from, 100-point defeats. Spain was a million years ago for this team because there's so little that were involved in Spain. I mean, Spain was during COVID, if we can remember that time, how long ago that seems. But for many of those players have moved on. So there wasn't really anything there, but important to get silverware, important to get confidence in the group. But it's still a very, very young side, very youthful side, not a lot of experience there.
But does that youthful aspect almost means that the confidence side of things is arguably even more important? Because I think, is it safe to say, younger players are probably a little bit more susceptible to those kind of swings of ups and downs and confidence than maybe more experienced heads?
Yeah, I would think so. And then there's the opposite. Sometimes with youth, they don't care and they just want to go, So there's probably a counterbalance there on that. But it is a youthful group and feeling its way through. And compared to, I read somewhere during the week, England have, 1,100 caps across their squad. And we don't have anything near that.
John O'Sullivan, John Cronin there was talking about you mentioned sevens with other countries and Kazakhstan. That's obviously been a big talking point forward and back with the women's game over the last couple of years is the availability of some of the sevens players to the 15s group. We were, before we started recording, we were kind of looking at when the sevens events are. There is only one sevens tournament during the Six Nations window, and it is during a down week. So as a result, Scott Beaman, the head coach in his first Six Nations campaign, has been able to name a number of Sevens players. Bavin Parsons and Eve Higgins are starting alongside Aveen Riley in the back line. They're all Sevens players this weekend. Where do you see that conversation in terms of the trade-off between Sevens and 15s? And, you know, clearly it's a positive that those players are available this time around.
It definitely is a positive. I think Eve Higgins is the best women's rugby player currently. I think Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe, in terms of her profile on Sevens, was probably the leading lady, if you like, there from an Irish perspective. But I think Eve has taken over that. Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe has been injured a little bit. Eve's a superb rugby player. I mean, she's one of the few people, for me, that is able to play both codes, 15s and 7s, with equal capacity. I think she's matured as a person. She's a lovely, bubbly personality. She's a very good rugby player, and she understands. She's physical, which is something that doesn't always translate from 7s, from when I look at some of the 7s players coming across to 15s. But she has that, and she's so many qualities. She's got a kicking game. She's got a great appreciation of the game itself. Her rugby IQ, I think, is much higher than many of the other players. And for all those reasons, I think she's a standout player. In terms of getting players from Sevens, you've got to, I suppose, in the first place, understand that some of these players have expressed a preference to play Sevens, and they're on Sevens contracts. So that's their if you like, if they're attaching a primacy to their rugby, that's their first choice. But I do think that in the context of this season, and as John has touched on quite rightly, with a young team, I think that I would like to see Eve Higgins and Aveen and Bavin stay with the 15s for the duration of the Six Nations. I think that the Sevens, given the latitude that they have with that win, that can be accommodated. They don't need to go to Hong Kong necessarily, and I would hope that they would have them available. They add a little bit of quality. The particular players that we're talking about will add a little bit of quality for me in the team, and I think it's very important. The irony is that it's arguably more important for them to play in the Scottish, Welsh and Italian games than it is to play against France. I think Ireland may struggle against France, but I think in those other three matches, it'd be a better fit for them to have more of an impact and more influence.
I don't think that's something we've been given clarity on, from at least all the quotes I've read, the interviews I've seen, and the build-up to the competition. I haven't seen necessarily that question asked of if, because like we said, the Hong Kong Sevens event is the first weekend of April, which is a down week. So it's after the Italy game, I think I'm right in saying. So obviously there's a player workload issue there if the Irish 15s players who are involved in the Sevens are then flying out. But I don't think anybody's said whether that's actually happening. But presumably, JC, it just makes a lot of sense. If you've picked a Six Nations squad, you've given these players to head coach Scott Beaman, just leave them there and don't be flying them from Dublin to Hong Kong.
So
back again.
Anyone who's been in the Six Nations squad is in the Six Nations squad.
Yeah.
They won't be in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is going to be a challenge for us at a Sevens level. I echo everything that John has said about Eve. I've coached Eve Higgins since she's 13 years old. She's a remarkable athlete, remarkable driven athlete, an athlete who just wants to grow and get better and get better all the time. I'm probably slightly going to disagree. This might be a little bit more controversial on this, of the inclusion. I think it's a remarkable about turn to bring the Sevens into the Six Nations. We just won in Perth. There's an Olympics in, you know, July, and we have a genuine chance of a medal. I guess it's about how do you prioritize the sport between Sevens and 15s. And when I look at men's rugby, the most important thing for Irish men's rugby, most important thing for Irish rugby is the Six Nations. So winning the Six Nations, it's financially floats everything from the union to all the clubs. And winning last week for Andy Farrell was, I've heard a figure of $3.5 million. Second, then, in terms of viability of the union is the World Cup. The World Cup actually costs us because we don't have November internationals and it's always a down year. Whereas in women's, it's different. And I would argue that the most impactful tournament that could impact for women's rugby would be an Olympic medal. And if I was to organise the hierarchy of women's tournaments, I would say Olympics first, 15s World Cup second, staying on the World Series third, because we get funding from Sport Ireland from that. Then you're into WX15s and the Sevens. But the one I would have last, incidentally enough, is the Six Nations. It's a private tournament. We cannot get relegated out of it. And there's no financial benefit for us. We don't lose anything where we finish. And you know, Barrett just has massive profile now because of the move to April, which I would fully support. It's just a profile angle of it and a lot of people's perception because of the history of the men's Six Nations. But in terms of, you know, in terms of importance, I wouldn't have it really there. And I look at the greatest player I have ever seen in my life is Anton de Pointe. I don't think I've ever seen anyone as good as him. He's still 26 years old, and I think he's the best player I've ever seen. He missed the Six Nations that took place 2 months ago to prepare for a World Series or to prepare for Olympics. And, you know, we've chosen to put players into a Six Nations now. And I hope it doesn't come at the expense of what we could do in Olympics after, you know, what's been 8, 9, 10 years of investment. But it's a remarkable about turn. It's a remarkable about turn.
Yeah, I would agree with John in the sense that I think that sevens should have primacy currently in the game. I think it's for a vehicle to get into the sport, if you like, it's sport of rugby. I think it's more attractive and it's an easier crossover, particularly for people coming from other sports. I also agree that if you're looking at what Ireland can achieve in women's rugby, then the sevens should have primacy. I think in the context of missing Hong Kong, I don't think it's the end of the world. I actually don't think that the three players that we're talking about, and let's face it, Bavin and Eve in particular would be frontline sevens players who will play a lot of the game time in sevens tournaments. I don't think it's going to affect them in the same way, missing one tournament, and then they go back into the sevens environment after the Six Nations. I do take everything else JC has said and all his points on that in terms of primacy where the competitions fall. I think that's very important that you look at it and you say, well, okay, what is the structure? What is the ideal structure for women's rugby in Ireland? And that's slightly different dynamic again in terms of how you grow that structure and how you develop. And you can't always be borrowing from Peter to pay Paul in that respect. And I think moving on from that, but yeah, definitely sevens.
I'll leave this open to either of you, but why then? Is it literally just because there was such clamour in previous years against the decision to not make the sevens players available that now all of a sudden the calendar kind of semi-works to get them in? Is that the only reason why we're doing this? Like if it is, obviously there's a disagreement on how much jeopardy there will be for the sevens programme for this, but why are we so, not desperate, but why are we so quick to bring them back into the 15s programme in an Olympic year? Like I said, I'll leave that open to either of you for that theory.
I think it probably indicates a shift in power within the RFU and a shift in focus. Anthony Eddy has left the sevens program. Evan Sephora leaves in a couple of months. It's been really their baby. From a sevens perspective, we have a wonderful team, but we have a team. We don't rotate as much on the World Series as, say, other nations. And we're reliant on probably a core of about 9 players, 10 players. So this makes it quite precarious when we're bringing those players into another code. So I think it's a shift in focus. I also think that the most pressure that comes on Irish women's rugby is as a result of the Six Nations. And we need positive news stories coming out of the Six Nations. So maybe that takes a bit more primacy, but it certainly seems to be shifting power.
Why do you say there's more pressure? Is it because it's the Six Nations, because of the history of the events? You know, you get the non-rugby folk watching it, so to speak. Is it just because...
And media coverage as well.
Yeah.
The likes of this podcast, the likes of it's on TV... For a duration, you know, there's a kind of a recognition around the Six Nations or the tradition of the Six Nations, coming more from the men's than the women's, but it's a tournament that's in front of the mind of the Irish public. And because it's a standalone tournament in April, it's exponentially moved in terms of attention and eyeballs. Whereas when we had it during the men's Six Nations, we had, you know, 9 games in the weekend between the under-20s and the men's, and the women's was stuck on 1 o'clock on a Sunday, and people were fatigued and never got any coverage. Whereas now it's an ideal window to get massive coverage. So that amplifies the good news stories, but also amplifies the bad news stories.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think the fact that you can go and watch the Ireland team play now, you can actually physically go to the games if you want, whereas on the World Series and the sevens, for most people, that's not possible. So this is something that stands alone. And it's comparing apples and oranges in terms of the men's, the influence, the money generated, all that thing. But that, for people who aren't aligned to rugby in a very direct way, they just see, oh, women's Six Nations is the same as the men's Six Nations. And now, because it's got a standalone time and that increased coverage, it makes a difference. It definitely makes a difference. This isn't the first time that Ireland have brought in some sevens players to play in a Six Nations Championship. It's been done before. It was done in a kind of piecemeal way, and it didn't really work. And it was like, you know, they'd stick Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe out in a wing. She wouldn't get a pass for 62 minutes in the game. They weren't capable of getting the ball there. There were lots of aspects of the performance where it was almost like the sevens players were a panacea for all the issues. And they weren't. They weren't. And when they played on the team, it didn't make it didn't have the desired effect that they wished for. And I think that then it was discarded, and there wasn't a lot of joined up thinking about how you would go about integrating them. They didn't have very much training time with the team. And it was all rather slapdash, basically, in terms of, oh, well, if we just introduce some players who are good at sevens into the 15s team, it'll work seamlessly. We'll get them the ball. But the problem more often than not was they didn't get them the ball, and performances suffered and confidence slipped. And then the sevens players, they also, having spoken to a number of them, they also didn't enjoy playing with the 15s.
It's a fundamental difference, John. And they're phenomenal athletes. Anyone who's in that sevens program are phenomenal athletes. But there's an adjustment coming across from sevens to 15s that I've found in my experience. So the first is about, so when a player hits a ruck in sevens, they tend to seal over it. The adjustment when I bring a player across from sevens to 15s is to go past the ruck, which we would do in 15s, but they tend to brace at the ruck and get blown out of it. The second thing is tackling. So tackling in sevens tends to be side-on, and they're exceptional side-on tacklers. But at 15s, you can tend to get a more direct. So sometimes the front-on tackles, they tend to suffer with a little bit, and they tend to get dominated. And the third thing is depth. You'll see if in the passing, sevens tends to be very deep because there's so much space. So they're just trying to outrun the defense. They've got space to do it. But you don't necessarily have that space in 15. So the adjustment we have with athletes coming across is understanding depth, that we have to draw and we have to give. And if we go as deep as we do in sevens, the defense is going to drift on us. We're going to concede 20 or 30 yards. Always when I've brought across players, that's been the biggest adjustment, is to try and adjust in there. And they get it. You can talk through it. But until you start doing it in practice and you start doing it in games, and it takes a while to adjust to do it.
I think that's a very good point. I was just going to make that. If you look at somebody like, so there's been a clamour for, say, to bring Nick Timoney into the men's seven squad for the Paris Olympics. But even the body profile, the weight and the shape of the players that are coming across, if you're playing sevens, it's a slightly different body profile that you need, where it's leaner, more athletic, more aerobic. And you've got to lose a little bit of the conditioning side of things that you need to be robust enough to play 15s, the 15s game. And I think that's a factor as well in it. Now, in a short space of time, I'm not sure, and John would be a better judge of this in terms of how much that has an impact in the women's game. But certainly I've spoken to a number of the men's players, and they're saying that your body shape, the way you're conditioned, is different between sevens. They've got to lose a little bit of weight that they would have in the 15s game.
It's certainly not as pronounced on the women's side. The body profiles, if you look at men's rugby, even take 15s, if you line up the Irish team, you'll have Craig Casey standing alongside Joe McCarthy, and there's a massive difference in height and weight in those athletes. You don't have that in women. Women tend to be broadly the same size, and you can have an out half that's as tall as the second row. And there's not as much weight or height differential, which means you can do more stuff in the women's game around positional, and you can be more creative around that. And the game is tactically different because of that. But certainly the same principle does apply, John, that certainly the sevens tend to be leaner because of the sheer distance and training they have to cover.
Let's move on to this weekend. And Ireland have named their team just before we started recording. What JC, what stands out to you there? I mean, straight off the bat, they got a 19-year-old uncapped winger in Katie Corrigan from Old Belvedere. She impressed in the recent Celtic Challenge. I think she scored a hat-trick in the last game for the Wolfhounds. So she's the only uncapped player. Is there anything else that stands out in that 23 to you?
Yeah, Katie Corrigan is excellent. I remember watching her playing with Tullo. Tullo do some phenomenal work on the ground of bringing young athletes through. And I watched her playing with Tullo a couple of times. She was excellent. Dan O'Brien, incidentally, is also from Tullo. But she's done really well. Again, very youthful. It's a big step up. The Six Nations is a big, big step up. And particularly when you're when you're that young and you don't have that much adult games. In my experience with players, as a, you know, if I get somebody in, it usually takes about 4 years in terms of technical, physical, mental and tactical development to get up to that level. It just because we don't really have the training age and the playing age like we do in the boys. The boys come out of schools and we've watched the schools finals this week and they're, you know, almost professional athletes as it is. We don't have that pathway with women, so it's a big step up. The other thing that jumps out is Nicole at 10. I coached Nicole for a number of years when she was in Dublin. She played with us. Really, really good player, but Nicole's been injured. You know, she played against us about 3 weeks ago for 20 minutes. So at 10, we're a little bit light because Dan has been injured and Nicole's been injured and Enya Breen's been injured. Now, I would probably argue that the best position for all three, they're probably all 12s. They're very effective 10s, but I always see them as more natural 12s. But 10 is going to be a challenge because of just game time. Nicole has been injured for quite a bit, as has Dan, as has Enya.
I've read a lot of what you've... I read all your tweets and I've read your pieces. The point you make about kind of centres of excellence and kind of trying... At the minute, they rely a little bit on the AIL clubs as those, for want of a better phrase. What did you make of this year's Celtic Challenge? They've obviously tried to do a little bit more around that piece of... I'm not sure if it was just simply to build national team cohesion a little bit more by basically... molding four provinces into two, more or less. But it did take away from that club game, didn't it? You look at the league table now, the league table is looking very different this year in the AIL than it has in previous years. Maybe that's got something to do with it, with the Celtic Challenge and players being away for long periods. So I know you've been very active in talking about where you put these centres of excellence, how you build a franchise model is something that I know you've advocated for in the past. What did you make of this year's Celtic Challenge and then the success of particularly the Wolfhounds with that kind of wider model in mind?
I think ultimately we've got to become athlete-centred and we've got to attract athletes. So I've talked a lot about the 10% versus the 90% athlete in female sport. So female sport is vastly, vastly different from men's sport. 10% of female athletes can play anything. They can be the best Gaelic footballer, AFL, soccer, cricket, rugby, basketball, whatever. And if they turn their hand to sport, once they pick up the technical element of that sport, they can be internationals. So Lindsay Peet's a great example. Vicky Wall is not. So Vicky Wall has won, you know, the All-Ireland with Meath, played AFL, and is now in with the Sevens. So those 10% athletes can turn their hand to anything. We have to build a structure that attracts those 10% athletes. So we need to go where they are. So where do 10% athletes tend to be? They're in population centres, which is, you know, Limerick, Galway, Belfast, Cork and Dublin, because they move there for college and they move there for work. And you have a proportionate amount of those 10% athletes there that you can structure a team around. You know, what I would have done with Railway, because we're in Dublin and Central, we had enough 10% athletes to attract and can set up a program that they want. I couldn't do what I did in Railway in Kilrush. I just don't have enough 10% athletes. And people won't buy. If I try and put out that, I'll only get a small portion of people that will come to it. The 90% athlete hates the 10% environment because they don't want, they're not driven. They don't want to do 3 days of S&C. They don't want to do video. They don't want to do data analysis. They don't want to do, they're playing for fun. They're playing for camaraderie, whereas you've got athletes who are playing for that. So playing for competitiveness and to achieve. So we have to build around the athletes is to my mind. And I don't think the AIL is the solution. I don't think, absolutely don't think the AIL is the solution. I think a franchise solution because, again, a lot of the issues with women's rugby is it's kept together by evangelicals in Ireland. So if you have an underage side, the chances are it's someone's dad or uncle who's running it for their team. And if, you know, you're having a club, often they're doing this without, you know, necessarily the support of the club or the province or the union, because the club is, all the clubs are generally men, male oriented, and they care about the men's first team and the men's seconds, and the men's 20s. So anyone that's doing it within a club tends to be an evangelical. And we've got to embrace these people and we've got to encourage them and help them succeed. And for me, it's almost building a franchise model that ultimately feeds into Ireland. That's controlled by Ireland. A draft system for athletes as they're coming through. You know, because on an underage team, you'll have like, if you have 20 athletes, two of those athletes will be 10% athletes, and they will be absolutely excellent. The 90% will be there for fun. If the coach caters for those 10% athletes, those 90% 90% will walk away. They don't want to be there. So a coach at elder age level, it's a very difficult thing to do because you've got to cater for the majority whilst keeping the minority interested. But for me, we've got to move them into that central piece.
And how do you get those? Because you've said again publicly in that franchises, I think you've said you put, what, 4 in Dublin, Limerick, Belfast, Galway, Cork. So I think what that takes you up to 8. Who's funding this? Is the IRFU funding it?
In fairness to the IRFU, they're spending an awful lot of money on women's rugby now. Like they've literally thrown money at this. Probably without addressing the governance and operational structures and the fundamental issues around the structure of the game here. But certainly it's not shy of money. You can run a program like this on 250, 300 grand. And that can be part supplied by clubs or by the franchise and part supplied by the RFU. And it's almost a franchise. The RFU give X, clubs give Y, which is essentially what they've done in England, where the RFU give an amount. And then the other aspect of it is with female sport, female rugby in particular, no one is getting wealthy out of this. So when I talk to athletes who have taken contracts, who are 3 years out of college now, and they've graduated with a degree to work in a particular profession, and they're on, you know, 15 grand contract, 20 grand contract, they're starting to think about the future. So if they do this till they're, say, 32, and they're 10 years from college and trying to go back and compete with new graduates who've moved up in the latest ideas, it's very, very difficult to come in because no one's getting rich on this. No one's retiring wealthy, but they're expected to train in a full-time environment in Blanchard's now. So that's difficult. But again, what England have done is allowed people, for the most part, everyone thinks England is professional. England league is professional. It's not. It's a kind of a semi kind of pro environment where they continue their education and continue their work. And we have to organize around the athlete because, again, with female sport, one of the nuances of it is if you finish, you're working with an employer who's guaranteed to sack you. So at some stage, your legs are going to go, you know? So that could be 32, 33, 34. But the other consideration we have around on a female side is family planning. So if I need a job, if I finish up rugby and I'm earning 15 grand a year and I need a job and I'm nearly inevitably in 2 year service to get maternity leave, you know, what job am I going to get? Am I going to get a 20 grand job and go on maternity leave? Whereas if I can maintain my career through it, you know, maybe I'm earning, you know, I've maintained a career, I've maintained rugby and I'm with an employer that I can make those family choices. And there's just nuances to female sport that are different. And I think we need to be more athlete centered in order to attract those athletes. And that's the key bit. And at the moment, I don't think that we're attracting those athletes. And I think other sports are. I mean, certainly the serious 10% athletes are going into soccer, into GAA, into AFL, even into MMA and boxing. Because women have a choice. They don't have to play our sport. We don't have a school system coming through. We don't have a natural through, but we've got to put something in place that the customer wants.
I'll continue my conversation with the two Johns after this short break. Welcome back to the Counter Rock. My name is Nathan Johns. I'm still here with John O'Sullivan and John Cronin as we preview the beginning of the Women's Six Nations Championship. John, this is Scott Beaman's first Six Nations. Obviously, he came in, I think it was July last year, they announced his appointment. Difficult situation to come into. You know, JC was saying it's difficult to take too much from what happened in October with that competition and that win. Is it a case of we need to see how he manages this group through a Six Nations campaign before we start making any particular judgments on his era at the top, so to speak?
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got to give him time. The only thing I would like to see from this Irish team is some coherence in the way they play, that they identify a style that suits the players that they have. There's no point in being aspirational and wanting to play something that you don't have the players to play. So you have to be functional to a certain degree. That doesn't mean you have to be dull or boring, but you have to identify a way of playing. And then you pick the team, the players that can do that. So I think for me, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see Ireland play a style of rugby that facilitates the talent that they have at their disposal, or brings the best out, enables the talent, rather, would probably be the right word for it, at their disposal. And I think that's very important. There's no point. You're not playing for effect here, in the sense you're playing to win matches or try and win matches or try and develop players. And also, you know, so I think that's very, very important. I think that France will be
will be too it'll be a step too far for them, I think. And that's not a massive revelation for anybody. But I would like to see, from an Ireland perspective, I'd like to see them play, identify a style. I'd like to see what Scott Beamond is thinking in terms of the way, the patterns that he is looking for from the players. And then I'd like to see the players have the courage to go out and play. And that's all you can ask them, do their best.
JC, just, you know, while we're talking about selection, the issue of Ireland hooker Cliona Maloney has come back up. She was in the press this week. She did an interview with the BBC. She's been excluded from the Ireland squad, despite playing quite well over in the English Premiership. In case anyone missed it, there was a bit of a semi-public spat on social media a couple of years ago. It was in and around the same time as the group of current and former internationals wrote that letter to government criticising the IRFU's treatment of the women's game. And there were some responses and from people within the IRFU. And Maloney accused Eddie, the former director of women's rugby at the IRFU, of slurry spreading. And they're now both not involved. Both figures are no longer involved in Irish rugby. It probably helps Ireland's cause that Maloney's replacement, so to speak, Niamh Jones at hooker, has been playing very well. She's been named Ireland's Player of the Year. But with that in mind, I know you've worked with Maloney. You'd probably be of the opinion that they should still be picking her.
Absolutely, of course. I mean, this is, you know, Dan Sheehan has been doing really well. So would we not select Ronan Kelleher then? Do we leave him out? It's, you know, Cliona Maloney is one of the best hookers in the world, to be honest. Cliona is a good friend of mine. And she's great. I've coached her since she took up rugby to play with Ireland. She's a great person. She's a great player. The flip side is Anthony Eddie is also a very good friend of mine. He's a great person. He's a great coach. And the desperately sad piece about this whole situation is, since the slurry comment, border out of Irish rugby, Anthony Eddie set up a sevens program, and there's two teams that are going to go into this Olympics, and Anthony Eddie's not going to be there. Cliona Maloney hasn't played for Ireland in 3 years, and that's desperately sad for both, because both are good people. And Cliona, you know, it's sad, but it's also wrong. And she probably kicked off what everyone involved in the game knew, albeit not phrased in the most elegant manner. She kicked off what ultimately led to that letter to the government. But singling out one player isn't right. The messaging of it feels wrong to me, particularly in female sport, where, you know, it tends to be male dominated on the coaching side. And that balance of power where, you know, effectively Cliona was, you know, not quite a, you know, maybe a whistleblower, but then to single out to say it to, and I've heard it from other athletes who've come back and said, you know, we essentially can't say anything anymore because we've seen Cliona was a message of, you know, if you step out, then if we can drop who was your player of the year and never pick her again without any consequence, then we can do it to anybody. And I just think that that's a very dangerous precedent to be setting in any sporting organization, any sporting organization, but particularly around where the balance of power is not quite equal.
Yeah, it's a really interesting situation. Difficult one for Scott Beamond to inherit, so to speak, when he came in, which is why it was particularly interesting to see him say, look, this isn't completely off the table during the upcoming Six Nations.
Expect him to say anything else, to be honest, because it wouldn't be fair on Cliona. Like, you can't, John has touched on this, if there is a culture within the IRFU or Irish rugby where you can't speak your mind trying to be constructive, then it's wrong. That culture shouldn't be allowed to continue or permit. You can't do that. You should be able to express whatever it is in the right way. So as things stand, I think it's very sad. And just, you know, John has touched on it already. He said, you know, for her to be excluded. But yeah, it's disappointing.
Be interesting to see what happens, whether if anything does materialise with the kind of both player and IRFU speaking about it publicly. It'd be interesting to see as the tournament progresses.
I was going to ask John on an upbeat note. Could you talk to me? I'm going to write a piece on Eve Higgins for Saturday's paper, but I'd love you to talk to me about her as a person and the qualities she has, not only as a person, but as a rugby player, and whether you would agree with the assessment that she is Ireland's best women's rugby player currently.
Yeah, she's certainly up there. I'll maybe tell you a couple of stories. When we had her at underage, she was obviously a superstar. So we started functionally assessing her when she was 14, giving her body weight exercises to ensure she avoids injury. We arranged S&C when she was ready. So there was always a stage program for Eve. But when she was playing underage, she was playing 10 at underage for us. And I banned her from scoring tries unless from first phase. I literally banner. I said, look, I don't want you just running through people from then. You have to pass the ball, and I want you to get a second and a third touch. And she goes, okay. And I said, you know, basically the Markella mantra, or the quote is from Markella. And she asked me, who's Markella? And I said, well, you need to go home and Google who Markella is. And that was Tuesday night. And she came back to me Thursday. And she said, I read about the quote. You know, if I touch the ball once, something will happen. If I touch the ball twice, we'll score. If I touch the ball three times, I will score. And then she's going, he retired at 26. Why did he decide to retire young? He was great. And I said, look, he just felt that he conquered everything. So that was our mantra with her, and that she couldn't score and she had to pass before and then get her support run. We brought her into our senior squad when she was 16 with a bib on her, or 15 with a bib on her, signifying no contact. Once we functionally assessed her, got it through, we started, she could initiate contact, and then eventually that, you know, we could train freely with Eve, and she was quite able for that. She was, you know, preternaturally gifted, just really, really gifted. I recall when she was in the fifth year in school, I rang Anthony Eddy and said that, you know, I have a player for you. I said, it's not a matter of if, it's when. And he'd know I'd know the standard because we had, you know, a lot of players up there, Stacey, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, okay. And I said, look, I'd take her in. We've taken her as far as we can. You know, I'd take her into the program for the summer. And he said, will she be able? I said, she'll go straight into the gym and she's straight able for you guys in contact. So that was fine. So he rang her parents. I gave him dad's number, Bernard. And I said, you know, talk to Bernard. But anyway, Iris, her mom was telling me when Anthony rang, she had a video of Eve on the phone to Anthony, you know, accepting the call to come into train with the sevens. Her first game, incidentally enough, Anthony rang me a couple of days after that and said, look, you know, Kinsale Sevens is on. Are you going to play her? And I said, well, I can't. She's 16. I said, you know, we can't play anyone under 18 under the rules in Ireland. And he goes, well, I'll take her with me. And I said, I'm Ireland. I can play who I like. So she can play with us. And I'll give you Nikki Kai. I said, okay, cool. I'll take Nikki Kai back and we'll put this on. And he said to me, he said, who would you prefer, Nikki or Eve? And I said, I'm absolutely not answering that question. But a super, super person, super family. What her parents have done, I mean, her dad used to be the taxi driver for her everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And the sacrifices they've done for her and to allow her to achieve her dreams has been phenomenal. And a super, super family, super, super person.
Yeah, no, I must say I'm very taken with her. I got to spend a little bit of time at a sevens tournament, seeing her up close, and I've followed her closely since, and just watching her play sevens rugby. I think that she's superseded everybody else in the team, and I have no doubt that you will. Anybody who watches Ireland play on Saturday will remember Eve. Eve will stand out, I think, even in the company that she's going to be in. I mean, the opposition in terms of the French team.
Right, JC, we'll wrap it up with kind of what to expect from Ireland more generally. As John says, look, the English and French games are what they are. I think everyone knows what to expect from that, especially with England. They've got some big names back. Emily Scarrett and Harrison are back in the fold there. The big question is, can they catch up with the other three? Italy at home in round two is obviously going to be a massive game. And look, if they can get close to Italy and try and write what happened last year when they lost all five games, there's no reason why they can't be competitive against Scotland and Wales again. With that all in mind, what represents success in this year's competition? Is it as simple a case of avoid a consecutive wooden spoon, or is it more, look, they should be closer to the likes of Italy, Scotland, and Wales and being more competitive?
I would be very fearful of France and England, and especially travelling there. First out, I think England in particular, it's on in Twickenham. It's for them. And I was speaking to one or two of the English players. This is a game that they're using, you know, one for profile, but also prep just a week before they play France, which is likely going to be the kind of championship piece for them. I think Italy is absolutely the key game for us. If we get a result there, that gives us momentum into Wales. Having said that, Wales have massively improved. They've done really well on the X15, the first division of that. They've massively improved in terms of contracts. The majority of the Welsh team are playing with Gloucester Harbury, and they're at the top of the Premiership. So there's a huge element of cohesion with them there. Scotland have a terrible schedule. They've got, you know, France and England at home, and then have to go away and win. But it depends what shape do we come in out of after the English game. But if we can get a result in Italy, that can maybe give us momentum into Wales, which may end up giving us momentum in Scotland. But Italy for me is absolutely key.
right, we'll leave it there. My thanks to John O'Sullivan and, of course, John Cronin for lending us his expertise today. You've been listening to the Counter Rock podcast sponsored by Nifty Business. My name is Nathan Johns. Please do subscribe and leave a rating wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next Monday.